You're listening to the Youth Crit Podcast on KHZ Network. Find us on Facebook at DecibelUNG Radio and find us on Twitter at DecibelUNG. If you like this episode, please leave a like and comment on our iTunes page at KHZ Network. And now for the podcast.
Michael, thank God. Look, I got a situation.
Mike, where's that ruler?
Arthur Edens just stripped down naked in a deposition room in Milwaukee.
You are the senior litigating partner of one of the largest, most respected law firms in the world. You are a legend.
I'm an accomplice!
You're a manic depressive.
I am Shiva, the god of death.
I'm Michael Clayton.
You're late. This is a $3 billion class action lawsuit. The architect of our defense has been arrested for running naked through a parking lot.
He's building a case against you, North.
Nobody's gonna let him do that.
Let him? Who the hell's gonna stop him?
I spent 12% of my life defending the reputation of a deadly weed killer.
Arthur.
No, wait!
They killed the Michael.
You, North, needs to know he's under control. They've been shook up. They need to be reassured.
What are you telling me?
That I'm counting on you?
I didn't want to say exactly what it was.
Just that it was something that would win the whole case.
I'm not the enemy.
Then who are? Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Youth Critic Retrospective. I am your host, Kale Smith. Joining me today is Brandon Cooley.
Hey, everybody.
Today, we are going to be talking about Michael Clayton. This is part two of our Oscar retrospective series that we're running this month. And, you know, I think this is, I kind of love this. I almost love this just as much as, No Country for Old Men. Just a little spoiler alert of this podcast. But yeah, it's really good. It was nominated for... Hold on, let me check again. Make sure I got the count right. 7 Academy Awards, including a win with Tilda Swinton for Best Actress in a Supporting Role. And it was nominated not only for Best Picture, but Best Director, Best Screenplay, Best Score, Best Supporting Actor, and then Best Actor. It was truly a year at the Oscars.
It should have beaten Juno for Best Original Screenplay, but they didn't.
Yeah,
it didn't feel the same way.
I mean, here's the thing. You know, Juno had a very. It's hard to judge a screenplay because you want to judge it for its uniqueness, which Juno definitely has, but also a screenplay is very not. It's not just dialogue. It's, you know. It's the blueprint for the whole script. Or, I mean, the whole movie, I mean. It's the blueprint for the whole movie, and while it doesn't have... And while Michael Clayton doesn't have quirky, unique dialogue, the dialogue is in service to the grand structure of the piece, which... And the grand story of the piece. So, in all the workings of a great classic loft thriller. So I think it should have probably won in hindsight, but I understand that Juno won because it has that quirky Diablo Cody dialogue that's so different from what you would normally hear. But in terms of like uniqueness and keeping the momentum, which is also, I guess, part of directing as well, but keeping the momentum of a screenplay going and keeping it, building it in the page is a lot harder than just, it's a lot more than just writing unique dialogue.
Yeah.
So Brandon, what did you think of Michael Clayton?
Yeah, as I said last time, it's one of my all time favorite movies. Probably this one in No Country for Old Men, There'll Be Blood, are in my top 50. So it was a pretty great year for movies in terms of the year. I'm unsure if it'd be my second or third favorite, but anyway, it doesn't matter. It's an excellent movie. It's one of my all-time favorite screenplays, I would say, in terms of the character arcs and just the structure of the movie. Kind of some of the themes too. It's been a while since I saw it, but I've seen it quite a few times, so I'm kind of going off of memory here. But great performances. Yeah, great performances by the three main players, George Clooney, Tom Wilkinson, and
Tilda Swinton.
Tilda Swinton. She won Best Supporting Actress, which I think is well earned. So yeah, all around pretty great movie.
It's a really good performance, but I feel like I've seen better from Tilda Swinton. So I don't know if she got the Oscar too early or not, but it's a great performance. Don't get me wrong. It's just one of those where I'm like, you know, her performance in Snowpiercer was a lot more hard work than, you know, this one.
I've never seen Snowpiercer, so can't.
Mm-hmm. I mean, she's done a lot more demanding roles since then, but, you know, this mm-hmm. probably, but her having this already in her pocket, you know, 10 years ago has led her to have much more unique roles and gave her a pedigree that was very well deserved.
Yeah.
So, yeah, and it's still a good performance. And, you know, I mean, I still think, I mean, and everyone else in the movie, you know, you mentioned Tom Wilkinson and George Clooney, they both give really incredible, all three of them give incredible performances.
Yeah.
And on top of that, it's just a really well done story that just has so many like twists and turns and it ends in a very interesting place.
Mm-hmm.
So Brandon, real quickly, how did you discover this movie? Because I'll just go ahead and admit it. This was the first time I actually have seen the movie and I actually just finished it. But how did you come to find Michael Clayton?
Well, the 2007 Oscars was the first time I ever watched like all five on DVD when they came out. Like before the Oscars, actually it was before, it was afterward maybe. It was in like around the time they came out in DVD. But so I kind of wanted to watch all five of them. And this is the first one I saw, I think. And yeah, I loved it immediately. There was stuff I didn't catch the first time because when I saw it, I was, I think, 13 or 14. So upon second viewing and third viewing, I kind of caught stuff that I didn't before, like how you notice at the very beginning that George Clooney's character, Michael Clayton, he has a gambling addiction. And that's right. It's not on the surface, but it's kind of an underlying plot of the, you know, a part of the character that may not notice the first time, but yeah, there's a lot of stuff in it that you keep noticing second time around third viewings. And I appreciate just the general like screenplay and the story when I first saw it, and the filmmaking too is pretty great. So yeah, I discovered it when it first came out on DVD back in the day.
Yeah. I mean, I have heard about this movie a lot. I mean, obviously, I heard it was nominated for the. It was actually the 2008 Oscars.
Mm-hmm.
But
well, for 2007, yeah. So.
Yeah, for 2007. These things are so. These things, I don't know how people don't say, can keep it all in track. Like, okay, so it came out in this, and then it came out in. And then it had an Oscar in this year.
I never call it the year the Oscars actually play. Like, this year is going to be the 2017 Oscars. I never actually call it the 2018 Oscars because that just doesn't seem right. Like, I just associate the movie with the year that came out, so there's no reason to really. It's kind of a weird thing to do. But
I don't know. Right. Mm-hmm. But yeah. So with Michael Clayton, I loved how from the get go you knew in 10 minutes who this person was. Like, you knew that he wasn't just the typical lawyer. He is, as he describes himself, as a very well-paid janitor mm-hmm. that comes up and legally cleans stuff up to and helps the law firm kind of come in and just kind of figure out like how to like clean the mess up enough to where they can fix it.
Yeah.
Like, so, and yeah, it's a little, and it's kind of in the opening is kind of funny because you are meeting the guy you know, that guy who had the hit and run, and you're just hearing the story, and it's like, yeah, this person's feeling fucked, and maybe him not wanting to hear that George Clooney's janitor is not the best way to go, and it's kind of, and, but you know what? He's the guy that they need. He's the guy, mm-hmm. and it's a, and for Clooney, it's like, this is an easy fix. I mean, we can, you know, you're a terrible person for leaving, for committing a hit and run, but this is an easy fix. This is, you know, nothing.
Yeah.
And that's really the whole tone of the movie, is that these are, you know, him and Alan, the Tom Wilkinson character, they're characters that are there to fix the fuck ups of, you know, more privileged, more privileged rich people that, you know, are just wanting to, that broke the law, and they're now like, and they need people to come in and clean it, keep them out of prison. And that's and it's so funny that this movie didn't come out like a year. If this movie came out like a year or two later, this would have hit a lot harder.
Really think so?
Oh, I think so. I think it would have hit a lot harder. I think because of how the recession and how it played out, and how, and then the bailout.
I'm not sure if it has that much connection to like the recession. I would say George Clooney's movie 2 years later, Up in the Air, definitely did. That was definitely a movie of its time, which is right, also one of my favorite movies too. But I'm not sure if this one does necessarily, because it's interesting because it's a movie about lawyers, but it's not a courtroom drama. It's one of the few that are like it's just about the life you have to live as a lawyer and the kind of ethical kind of dilemmas you have to make, you know?
Right.
In the process. So, but yeah, I'm not sure if it's a connection to like the bailout or the recession, because there is no they're not really doing all the stuff in order to make a living, you know, because they have to in order to put food on the table. It's more about just how friendships are kind of tested through this court case with E-North. Is that the name of the company?
E-North,
yeah. And it's not even about the greed of the company. It's about her attempt to just, like, she, I'm not sure what you even call her personality type, that her need to just cover things up and not, like, I'm not sure what you'd call that.
It's her need to not keep, it's the need to keep the company out of legal trouble.
Yeah.
And more, unfortunately.
Paranoia, maybe. That may be the best way to put it. It's not greed, because that's what a lot of movies, the trap they fall into, is the evil company is greedy, you know, but she's not that kind of character. She's the villain, but she can tell she's nervous. You can tell that she's doing this, like,
you can tell she has regret, or I mean remorse.
Yeah, like she thinks it's a last resort, but in the end she ends up killing people. I mean, that's like, it gets to that point and it's all very believable, you know. It's probably and in the actual court case is about the chemicals actually killing people, literally. So it's, and that's realistic. That's, that kind of stuff happens with Monsanto and companies like that. So
yeah it is. And but the thing about her character too is she has to also, and this will get a little repetitive, she also has to, she's basically she's part of the company head, where she has to basically keep it above water. And mm-hmm. right now there's a risk of drowning. She can't present it to the board that way, but there is a risk of the company drowning, you know, under all this legal, you know, this legal kind of fuck ups that, and, you know, things that kind of went, you know, things that went under, like, under notice, under when she was not under control. So, and mm-hmm. she's trying to cover that up so her company can move forward and she can possibly even either do better or make even worse mistakes.
Yeah.
So, and that's really what the story is about, is, you know, trying to cover up to a certain extent. And ultimately at the end, George Clooney just kind of gets fed up with it all, mostly because his life was almost taken from him, but, in a car bomb. But yeah, it goes to so far that they become careless with the car bomb.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's a, you know, and I don't think enough is said about how great of a first time filmmaker, like how great this was for a first time filmmaker in Tony Gilroy,
mm-hmm.
because, Tony Gilroy up to this point was, he was a screenwriter that was mostly well known for espionage thrillers, the Bourne franchise, and I think that's it. He's just been mostly known for political and espionage thrillers, primarily the Bourne franchise, and even by the time this movie came out, he was kind of already trying to wiggle his way out of the Bourne franchise. So it's interesting that his character is also trying to wiggle out of what he's trying to do while he was trying to also like keep out of a major franchise.
Yeah. So he's saying he didn't want to do the Bourne legacy when he was given the project?
Because you have to also understand, in between this and Bourne Legacy, he did Duplicity, and Duplicity it didn't do well at all. First of all, it cost way too much money. It cost $60 million for, like, a corporate rom-com drama.
Yeah.
It cost way too much money. It cost $60 million, and it never really was a hit in the first place. Like, it just never caught wind and could never recover. So it was a bomb. And I think Tony Gilroy and he was looking at a way of, well, I could probably do this like side story that's happening in the Bourne franchise. And to be honest, he didn't hate his experience working on the Bourne franchise. He just was never happy with what Paul Greengrass and Matt Damon were doing to his.
Well, that's interesting because Paul Greengrass ones are the best ones out of the. Well, I would say the first three are the best, obviously, but Paul Greengrass did a great job on him. So, so he wasn't impressed by that?
I think him and Damon and Greengrass had different visions on where the franchise should go. I think he wanted more in tone of what the Bourne identity was. But Matt Damon and Paul Greengrass were more into exploring the character, and I think there was just a conflict of interest in both parties. And so it's interesting now that they're not together making Bourne movies, that you kind of see like which one, you know, what Tony Gilroy would do if he had full control of the franchise in the Bourne Legacy. And then you have Paul Greengrass and Matt Damon, what they did without Tony Gilroy at all in Jason Bourne. And both movies have not fared well after the third one. So it's interesting to see where that franchise went off when they both split in a different direction. So interesting. And that's kind of the most unfortunate thing is after this, he did do Duplicity, but again, that didn't do very well. And also, he hasn't made a movie since The Bourne Legacy. And I don't think he's currently on tap to do anything. The last thing he was kind of like involved in was Rogue One.
Oh, really? He was? Okay.
He was a screenwriter and allegedly it's still like, as I do air quotes, allegedly that he was like the ghost director that did all the reshoots.
Oh, okay. Interesting.
He did co-write Beirut, which was a Sundance hit, or the Sundance drama, which was at Sundance this year.
Okay.
He's still been writing. He actually co-wrote the Matt Damon Great Wall. He did after Duplicity, State of Play, as a writer. He's been writing around, and he produced his brother Dan Gilroy's Nightcrawler.
Okay, yeah, that's fair.
And he's actually been a consulting producer on House of Cards for a season. He was like a consulting producer for like a season or two.
Interesting.
So yeah, it's interesting where that career went. And I hope Tony Gilroy directs again. It's just And it's just, it has, he hasn't quite caught fire after Michael Clayton.
Yeah, it's definitely true. Mm-hmm. It's unfortunate because it's such a good movie, but yeah. let's see what else. Yeah, I love the ending in this movie too. Not to spoil it for everybody, but they've probably already seen it or plan to watch it. Just the way they executed it. Or actually, the whole structure of the movie, the way that lends to the ending, is really well done. They did the thing where they start off in the middle. They start off with the scene from the end and then flashback. And it's a risky thing to do in a movie, but it works pretty well in this one. Because who doesn't? Everybody's pretty much interested in a car bomb. And kind of shows the way how it leads up to that. And some movies don't do it well because they just kind of shoehorn in. I mean, like, for example, last night I was watching Don't Breathe. Have you seen that?
Yes.
And that's a great movie. I really enjoyed it, especially the technical aspects and just the filmmaking. The problem, though, is that they began the scene with the ending. Like, they had, like, a quick 30-second, like, scene of the very last act of the movie. Really the very last scene. And it was really, it just reminds you that it's going to end up in that place, you know, it's going to actually, like,
right. Yeah.
And so there's really no purpose for it. It's not really a hook either. Cause you know, it's a horror movie. So you're not really like, it's yeah. So, but Michael Clayton though, you know, it's going to end up in that direction with the car bomb going off,
but you don't have much context to what.
Yeah, happening. Exactly. There's no context as to why or who's trying to kill him or if, anybody's trying to kill him or what's the, you know, what is the context? Yeah. So that's an effective way of doing it. And not ruining the ending or giving too much away.
Yeah. I mean, you know, what's going to happen, but it's kind of like one of the better, like, episodes of Alias where they open, yep, you know, with something that happens in the last act of the show. And then they cut back and then they kind of reveal, like, how they got there, or better yet, Mission Impossible 3. So,
yeah, that's a good example. Yeah, I was going to mention Breaking Bad was the best at doing this because they would usually start off an episode with the scene from the last season. It was always out of context, like the teddy bear in the swimming pool, you know.
Right.
That's the kind of thing that is like these haunting kind of images, you know, that you kind of keep them in your mind until the end of the season.
Season 2, and then I think all of season 5, all parts of season 5 did that as well.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a really good writing device if you can get it right. The thing is, though, is you do end up, if you're not careful, you end up the same problem that Don't Breathe has, which is, well, we know where this is going to go. We have the context, so we're just waiting up until
that point. Yeah. It's definitely a risk.
Yeah, but I mean, it works. This whole movie works very well, and it's just a really good, like, sit down thriller. It's not a quiet 2-hour like thought piece, not saying anything, not disregarding those kind of movies, but it's, you know, but it's a, you know, I was never bored. And it didn't require a lot. It's one of those movies where you can sit down with friends and enjoy it over at Netflix.
Yeah.
It's a great movie like that. So,
great opening scene too. I forgot to mention the very effective, like, his narration, like, cause at that point you don't know who this guy is, you know, it's Tom Wilkins obviously, but you don't know that he went off the rails, you know, and just a great, like, the images of the building and the empty rooms right before they get to the one of all the lawyers. Like, it's such an effective way to open a movie. Cause you're like, something's not right with this guy. Like, you're like, what is going on here? It's one of those effective opening scenes, you know? Like,
Yeah, you're right. It is. It's very effective. I mean, you get the sense that this person is on this crazy manifesto, but you don't, like the rest of the opening, you don't know the context, but you're interested.
Yeah.
You're interested in this person. So, with that, I mean, I highly recommend Michael Clayton. It was great to look back. It's funny to see all the cell phones in the movie. 'Cause it's, you know, obviously we all have like flip phones that or obviously now we have, you know, iPhones and with touch screens and on it, and everyone still has like Blackberries and flip phones, and it was a little nice fun, you know. Oh, this is definitely 2000s.
Yeah, although I don't really feel like movies that decade have ever really aged in any way in terms of the technology, because I guess we don't really see flip phones anymore, but The Departed is the same way, and The Departed, they're constantly using flip phones. I don't really think much of it. It's just kind of one of those things that it's not as aged as them using like those giant computers in the 90s and like the fax machines, you know, like it's not as
The dial up.
Yeah, stuff like that. Yeah,
it's I know, but well, it's just kind of like, oh yeah, like okay, yeah, that it was just like, oh yeah, I remember having those.
Yeah,
is that kind of deal. I highly recommend Michael Clayton. Brandon, do you have any final thoughts on Michael Clayton?
Not really. I think I mentioned at the beginning it should have won Best Original Screenplay, but I can't think of much else. I mean, I think No Country for Old Men is still my favorite movie of the year, so I'm not sure if I would say it. Yeah, I don't know. It's probably, yeah, it was kind of it's kind of underrated, I think. It's not remembered as much as No Country or There'll Be Blood. It was unfortunate, but yeah.
So. Yeah, if I was you, the audience, I would definitely recheck this out, because this is definitely an underrated gem and it should be rewatched. And it's currently on Netflix. I was surprised to have browsed through and be like, oh, it's on Netflix. So please check it out. It's fantastic. It's just a well-written movie and it's engaging all the way through. That's all I can say. It's fantastic. All right. So before we go, we are gonna, speaking of Juno, speaking of winning original screenplays, Juno is the next movie that we are talking about. So we'll be back next week with that. And then of course we'll do, and then after that we'll go back to There Will Be Blood, and then we'll talk about No Country for Old Men finally. Brandon, thanks for coming on.
Yep.
You don't have any social media stuff, right?
Nope.
All right. And you can find me on Twitter at MovieKale. You can also follow me at The Youth Critic. And then you can also follow the channel that distributes this podcast at KHD Network. Thanks, everyone. We will be back with you next Sunday for Juno.
The prognosis, Fertile Myrtle, minus or plus?
There it is. Little pink plus sign is so unholy.
That ain't no Etch-a-Sketch. This is one doodle that can't be undid, Holmes Gillett.
Just tell him. I'm pregnant.
Who is the father?
It's Polly Bleeker.
Polly Bleeker? I didn't think you had it in.
I know, right?
Did you see that coming?
Yeah, but I was hoping she was expelled or into hard drugs.
Her DWI? Anything but this.
I could like have this baby and give it to someone that like totally needs it.
You should look in the Penny Saver.
They have ads for parents.
Yeah. Desperately seeking spawn.
Hi, I'm Vanessa.
Hi, I'm the husband.
This, of course, is Juno.
Like the city in Alaska.
No.